Pine Book, and how does he come into it, and what is his...
I have a New York Times story, if you want it, right after the, I think I referred to it as frame up. Right after the guilty plea hearing, what I call a mini trial, where they refer to four books that had already been contracted. McMillan's was one, and he wanted to come back to McMillan's. Frank's was another. Frank began with two contracts, each for a minimum of $100,000. And all of these books were predicated upon Ray's singular guilt, the old Oswald formula.
Sure. Who were his two contracts with?
Who what?
Who does Frank have contracts with?
Doubleday and Bannon. And that's why it was one of the reasons why it was so wrong for Temkin to be the witness to the state. But that may be also how they got him, I don't know. Now, I use talk shows as a means of getting evidence. One was the Jerry Williams show in Boston, which I did by telephone with Frank on the other end. Frank in the studio, it's a stacked deck. It's very hard to do it when you're not live in the studio. And the other was the St. Louis one. And I got Frank to admit...
Which is the one in St. Louis?
I have to look it up. It's the Independent Station, Channel 11. And it was a black man show, and it was a Saturday night show, or a Sunday night show. The station gave him special permission to run overtime that night. That's the show Lowy was on that I told you about.
How are you spelling Lowy?
L-A-U-E. And that was rather difficult because I was in association with J.B. Stoner and Jerry Ray. And Stoner went off on all kind of wild, crazy stuff. But I got Frank to admit that he had had 40 private meetings with the man who became Judge Dwyer, who was actually in charge of the case. Frank prints in his book copies of documents which we haven't yet seen.
Okay, that's what made me think of it. We were talking about those autopsy pictures.
That has a different story. I'm talking now about one of the so-called sets of stipulations.
Let me ask you one thing. What are the dates of those contracts? They're pretty early, or the Frank contracts?
I don't know when they were executed, but the story appeared immediately after the mini-trial hearing, as I remembered on the 18th. I referred to it in the frame-up, and I have the New York Times story. Now, the autopsy pictures are a different situation, and I'll give you a little bit of local color that you may enjoy, but I don't think you'll use. I told you about the show that Foreman fled, where Haynes and I were alone. Thereafter, partly because Foreman had threatened the station with a spurious libel suit, you know, the unspoken libel. The station was worried. So I found out by accident that they had arranged a show with Huey and Dwyer without any other side. I wanted to be on that. The way I got on it was saying, all right, don't you do it. I got four radio shows lined up, and you're going to have black picket lines around your goddamn station. I did say it, and I did mean it. And I did have the shows. So they finally called me up and said, all right, you're going to have to be very quiet. And I said, you know how quiet I am. Huey at first refused, and then finally he agreed, provided I was not on the set when he had an uninterrupted 15 minutes to begin with. I agreed to it. They had me in the sponsors booth, and I made notes. But the deal was that the time would be divided equally, and if Huey wouldn't want to be interrupted, I wouldn't be interrupted. I didn't get a chance to get a word out of it. But in any event, I really blew Huey. And Judge Dwyer was there, and I was prepared for both of them. And with Dwyer, I had the transcript, and he didn't even know the stuff that he had put into evidence himself. And I read it to him.
Okay, now we're talking about on this talk show.
Channel 5 in New York. I got tapes of both from the station. I blew Dwyer with his own ignorance of his own case and the transcript. And Huey, when he interrupted me with one of these long tirades, and I let him go for a while, and finally I insisted on being heard. Yes, Mr. Huey, you've given us the name of the whore with whom Ray lay in Portugal, and you've told us how much you paid another one in Mexico. But this has nothing to do with the killing of Dr. King. Mm-hmm. I said, why don't you tell us now, Mr. Huey, what investigation you made in Memphis? The crime was committed in Memphis. Mm-hmm. And you're this big investigator, and you've conducted this tremendous investigation. Won't you please tell us what investigation you conducted in Mexico? And he went like Vesuvius. He called me a racist, and I just sat back and laughed and enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. But Jerry Frank was in the audience. Now, how will I know this? The station was very anxious to keep me separated from these people, and I didn't care about that. But I had to go to the toilet. So I asked how to go to the toilet, and they told me. And when I came back, by accident, I opened the wrong door. And there was Huey and Judge Dwyer and Judge Dwyer's wife, as I remember it, and Frank and the daughter of one of these people. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, excuse me. And then Huey invited me in. Mm-hmm. And I had barely gotten in. Huey saying how he wanted to meet me when this young woman from the station came in, almost in tears, and took me out. So that's how I knew Jerry Frank was there. Well, meanwhile, there was a young man in the audience who, you know, the people are afraid all kinds of things going to happen to you. Mm-hmm. So this guy was in the audience with a hidden tape recorder, and he had the microphone literally down his sleeve. You know, it was pretty far up, but it really happened. Mm-hmm. So when the show was over and I've blown both of these guys, mm-hmm. Frank comes running up to me, and I don't see it. And I mean running.
Yeah.
Because Frank is worried about his whole goddamn book, which hasn't come out. And this young man, seeing Frank running up, thinks Frank's going to attack me.
Yeah.
So he doesn't even stop to think he's got his tape recorder running. He comes running up in case Frank does attack me, because I'm not even looking at Frank.
Yeah.
And Frank starts blabbing all this stuff, including how he's got all the autopsy pictures. So this young man got it on tape, and I got the tape.
That's separate,
you see, from his meetings with Dwyer.
Okay, fine. But he doesn't run the autopsy pictures in the book. I just got the book last night as I was looking.
Yeah, no, he doesn't have the autopsy pictures. And he'd get in trouble over that.
Okay.
He'd violate the rights of privacy of the King family, and he'd blow his whole pretense.
Okay. Does the King family have any autopsy pictures?
No.
Okay.
But you can't violate their rights to privacy.
Fine, okay. But Frank is glad to you that he's got the pictures.
Yeah, and this is how. It was just incoherent blabbing.
Right, okay.
You know, $200,000, his big reputation.
Right. Okay, let's go back.
There's a lot of fiction and craziness in that Frank book, and substantial stuff that he still doesn't understand.
Okay.
By which I mean Frank is not the only blabber.
Fine. He gets to Dwyer, he's got these two contracts, and obviously Dwyer's willing to talk to him because he says he spent 40 hours.
40 meetings.
Okay, 40 meetings.
They would pick this guy up at the airport. I believe he told me he stayed at Canale's home.
Mm-hmm. So this is after the case is finished, as far as that's concerned.
Yeah.
Now, is that, that's not an ethical problem anyway. I mean, that's an okay thing to do.
No, on the contrary, it is an ethical problem.
Is it? Okay.
Because they gave Frank what the defense still doesn't have. You should understand that under the canons, the primary obligation of the prosecutor is not to get a conviction, mm-hmm. but to see to it that justice is done. Now, this is a simplification of a legal situation in which they withhold from the defense what the defense is entitled to and give a commercial writer, in order to bribe him to write favorably about them, what the defense doesn't have and isn't even in the record.
Okay, my question is now, though, the defense never asked for it at that point.
Oh, no. It's not a question of the defense not asking for it. It's a question of the defense not being able to get it. We've asked for it.
Now, but I'm talking about the time we're talking about, when Frank is sitting with Dwyer.
The defense
is not asking for it, and the case
before,
is pretty dead.
That was before we were the defense. That's right.
Right, okay. So at that point, they are resisting nothing. Now they are. You can say, hey, look, he gave it to everybody. You know,
you're kidding if you're thinking they weren't resisting then. They started resisting right away. And I got all of this on tape, first person.
Okay.
Ray had to get Foreman off of his back. Foreman's whole campaign, as Jim will explain to you, mm-hmm. was to convince Ray that Farmer was going to put him away and frame him. And he succeeded. But as soon as Ray left the jail, left the courthouse, even, I mean, he even told his guards when they were taking him to Nashville.
Yeah, they're going to feel it.
Yeah. So it's reported. And the first, and he's fired, he's fired Foreman.
Right.
So it is Beasley. Now, this is not privileged. I did not get this under the judge's protective order. Beasley is the one who calls up the warden.
Yeah.
To find out from Ray who represents Ray.
Yeah. Sure.
And Beasley is the one who saw Judge Barrett. And Beasley developed a speech impediment in the process for it. There are three lawyers who go to meet for the first time at Nashville after Ray has said he's going to appeal. I've forgotten the exact date, but this is all recorded. One of them is J.B. Stoner.
Mm-hmm.
Another is a fly-out type Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And the third one is a very fine conservative gentleman who is a strong Wallaceite named Ryan in Memphis.
Mm-hmm.
And Ryan and his wife were very nice. My account comes from Ryan. On his tape recorder in his office.
Mm-hmm.
They got to the jail and they were denied access to Ray. Ryan, meanwhile, has been approached by Jerry. Will he represent Jimmy? Jimmy knows nothing about this. Jimmy is locked up.
Mm-hmm.
So Ryan prepares a motion. They all meet at the jail. The warden won't let them in.
Mm-hmm.
And he gives as his reason the direct order that the warden, I think, was Lake Forest, Lake, but in any event, I have his name, I forget, Russell.
Mm-hmm.
He gives as his reason a direct order from the Commissioner of Corrections, Avery. Now, you may remember Avery was saying Ray wrongly and was planning his own book.
Right.
So these guys can't get in to see Ray. Mm-hmm. Ray doesn't know any one of them. He's never, you know, he's had no contact with them.
Right.
The three lawyers get together, they disagree on the exact formulation of the motion.
Mm-hmm.
They make some handwritten notations in a handwriting totally foreign to Ray. They won't let any lawyer in to say, this is ours. Ray is afraid to sign the paper. The whole thing hinges on this one incident.
Right. And they can't get in.
So that paper wasn't filed timely.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no question about the fact that these men represented Ray. There's no question about the fact that the prosecution knew it. Through Beasley, who called up the warden and found out from Ray.
Okay.
You talk about corruption and dirty tricks.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Frank is spending all his time with Dwyer.
Among others.
Right. He's going in with pretty good intentions, though. There's no reason to think that Frank has anything else.
Frank has pretty good intentions?
I don't know. I mean,
how generous can you be? Remember, his contract calls for a book with a preconception of Ray's solitary guilt.
Mm-hmm.
He can talk all he wants to about having an open mind.
Mm-hmm.
There is no other possibility in the book.
Mm-hmm.
He never considers anything else.
Mm-hmm.
All of this evidence I have discussed with you is missing from his book.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But again,
the only thing Frank did on his own was talk to people.
Now, in the case...
Not the only case, by the way. Even magazines say that they did that with.
The evidentiary hearing. Now, Frank was deposed. He didn't show up either, right?
No, sir. He wouldn't even comply with discovery orders.
What were the discovery orders that...
The judge directed that he deliver certain documents in his possession to the defense. He wouldn't do it.
Uh-huh.
McMillan stonewalled in a different
okay,
way.
Okay, Frank, what was the thrust of what you were asking from Frank? The fact they spent all
I've forgotten the details on that, and rather than misinform you, I'd rather have you ask Jim that.
Okay, you mentioned something about the stipulations in the Frank book that you read.
Frank prints a set of stipulations we haven't found yet. He prints them in a supposed facsimile. The interesting thing is that they do not have a signature. and they are not in the court records. I've gone over it in 1971.
What are the stipulations about? What are the stipulations?
It was in the negotiations, the last step of the guilty plea, what Ray would admit to. They're in the appendix of Frank's book, I forgot.
Yeah, I remember, Jim mentioned it once, and I said, don't even talk to him about it, having seen the book, because, you know, it's really obviously, this is time consuming as it is, but when I don't know anything, it's how they want it.
What Ray agreed to is another story. I've got the originals of the, what he signed. I got Xerox, and I've examined the originals. They used the felt tip pen. I think it's 3 pages long, I've forgotten it, but I have it. And another thing that is kind of mind-blowing is that the whole voir dire was scripted like a high school performance.
Mm-hmm.
There came a point, the foreman had Ray so scared, and Ray would never admit he was scared. The foreman had him so scared that when in the course of actually reading this, Judge Battle skipped from the middle of one line to the middle of the next line. Ray picked it up and corrected it.
Mm-hmm.
I've made the word-by-word comparison. I have these documents.
Yeah.
It was scripted. The difference is that they left out Ray's innate politeness like saying, sir.
Yeah.
Other than that, it was word for word.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very unusual voir dire.
Yeah.
Where they write out the parts.
Well, yeah, I have no idea what that proceeding usually involves.
Well, I think that any lawyer you show it to will tell you it's a very exceptional way of doing it. Hello? On the phone. Yes, sir. Yeah. Do you mind if I make a suggestion? Partly because of somebody with me. Do you know Mark Allen? Well, Mark is working on this, and Floyd Lamour at the University of Maryland is working on this with one of Allard's people. Her name is Andrea. Yeah. Well, we had worked out an arrangement on this at Maryland, and it would be better if you could get hold of one of them, and I was telling Mark just last night that I think all you people ought to get together on this, and then probably I can supply you with documents to go with it. Yeah. But go ahead. Been done repetitiously, but not for that forum. And what is conceived of now, and what was agreed to by all of us at that thing at Maryland, what was really at the party afterwards, was to agree on certain essential points and just do these in the form of a terse bill of particulars with documents attached, just to make a prima facie case that the job has to be done. Well, different people separately. It was agreed originally that Mark Holm, what's Holm's first name, not Mark? Mike Holm and Mark Allen would do it for the Virginians. And when they didn't, Floyd started doing it for the Marylanders. And then Mark called me last night. And I had thought that either Andrea or Purdy would be in on it, but Purdy had to go to Philadelphia, and I don't know where Andrea is. Well, there was one variant of this, by the way. I had suggested that in order to have a judgment separate from mine, you all asked Sylvia Marr to give you a list of maybe 10 or 15 or 20 points, no more than a list. Did she? Well, since then, she's taken sick. A week ago Sunday, I had to be in New York, and I called her. And her asthma was pretty bad, and she was going out to a place she has on Fire Island for 2 months, just to rest and get some fresh air. And she couldn't do it, and when I raised this question with her, the judge, an independent of mine, she said, why fool around with that? Tell the kids to go through whitewash, and I first took them to pick out what they want. She said, it's all in there. So Floyd has spoken to me about this. He will be speaking to me about it again. But I think that it would be better if all of you, especially if you cross all the political lines in it, were to pick these things out. Then I agreed to get together with them at several different times. First, when they had decided on what points, and they could get my opinion on that. And then after they had drafted the bill of particulars. And at that point, I said I would go through my files and see what I could give them by way of a documentary illumination. Yeah. Compromise of what? Well, that's going to be there. If they ask my opinion, I'll give it to them, and I know what it is, and I'm not going to intrude. You should know that I can't agree with Bud. I don't think he has a monopoly on being wrong. But I don't want to even see. I made one suggestion to that office, and Rick was there when I made it to Tiny. And Jim was there, and they worked it out in their own handwriting. That represents my belief. Now, it could change if I knew other things, but I don't want to appear to be in the position of encouraging them to change their resolution unless they ask my opinion. Can you understand that? I'm quite willing if they want me to, but unless they ask me to, I'll take no initiative. This has to be their thing. They have special survival problems you and I don't have. And I don't think we should be pressuring. I don't think that that's practical at this point. Well, I'd like to read the thing and have a chance to think it over. Will you command me a copy? Just Route 8 Frederick, zip code 21701. No, 21701. Fine then. That was a good meeting. I was very impressed with that. Well, we'll have another one when he comes back. I think he said it was going to be in August, didn't he? Yeah. Okay. Fine. Thanks, Ed. Right. Bye.
Bobby Kennedy time, right?
That's Bobby. Howard.
Hello, and say, yeah, it's got to be.
Came here midnight one night. Night before he went back to California, and this was the president of the student body at Notre Dame who drove him here. His name is Ed Burns. And there's a whole bunch of manipulation on the bill on what kind of a resolution you can get behind it.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to get involved in that.
Yeah.
I told Downing's people what I thought was a defect in their resolution. Gonzalez was a loser.
Right.
Whether Stockman and I is a good guy or not.
Yeah.
And they had agreed to recommend to Downing a certain amendment. I don't know if he made it or not. I don't want to know.
Sure, that's not you.
I got my own approach on this. I'll help anybody. Mm-hmm. But tomorrow there's somebody else coming here. And I've got enough for what you could expect the Senate or the House to do. I've already done it for them.
Yeah.
They can't begin to do what they got to do on the CIA.
Right.
This becomes essentially an Well, this becomes a sense of energy. It's still running.
Sorry.
I didn't think to turn it off.
But go ahead. Where were we?
We can go way back and go over that if you like.
No, I don't care about that.
Okay.
I just forgot where we were when the phone rang.
Okay, we, I was talking about,
The books.
Yeah, the Frank. That's right, so really, his, he came in just looking from the point of view that man has confessed single guilt, and he's gonna go out and do the most comprehensive proof of that he possibly could, and that's what he...
Well, what he was looking for was what could make a movie. Not truth.
Mm-hmm.
Of all of these people, there's not one who as an investigator could find women in a bordello. They report and don't understand what they report.
Mm-hmm.
It's unbelievable. The more money they get, the more incompetent they are, except as commercialized. They can do a beautiful job of presenting a case, presenting a story. They're good professionals this way.
Right.
But that doesn't mean they're investigators.
Okay. Haynes. Haynes, you think, was hopelessly compromised by his contractual obligation to Huey. There's no way that he could have defended.
He couldn't escape it.
Mm-hmm.
There was a better chance. Ray had a better chance under Haynes than he did under Foreman.
That's what it looked like to me from what I read from you and everything else is that...
But put yourself in Ray's position. When all of a sudden Huey offers you $12,000 to fire Haynes and not go to trial and not take the witness stand.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, I don't think anybody can begin to understand the pressures this man, who had no special education and no special experience in life, was subjected to.
Mm-hmm.
Just a normal human term, this whole thing is incredible. And how he could have survived under it just defies imagination.
Mm-hmm.
Survived in any form.
Yeah.
Enormous pressures. Oh, you talked before about the story of Ray saying he was sitting downstairs in the car. This reminds me of it.
Right.
You wonder what the truth really is?
Mm-hmm.
The deal with Huey was, again, this cosmetic business. Ray needed good public relations. That's the way they sold him. And all Huey does is plead Ray guilty in everything he writes and everything he says. That was his preconception.
Right.
You ought to read his testimony before the grand jury where he shouldn't have appeared. The only transcript ever made in the history of Shelby County. And everything else, we have
how
a lot
you
of
get, how did you get the Huey grand jury?
Under discovery.
Okay. Did that come
it
out
was the only one made in the history of Shelby County, and Percy Foreman didn't stop it, and it was after the trial was supposed to have been held, so it served no grand jury purpose. It's one of the things I gave parts of to Bud. Remember telling you the story about when Ray Sell, I'm preparing him for Temkin?
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the things I had with me to use.
Okay, let's go through that Huey grand jury testimony again, just I want to make sure that
Huey began convinced that Ray was guilty.
Okay, when was that grand jury?
He was trying to buy a confession from him. But the deal was, Ray would not agree to talk about what happened on the day of the crime.
Mm-hmm.
Incidentally, Martin can give you an interesting story on this, because I had a special problem.
Martin
Walden.
Oh, Martin, okay.
how do you get Ray in an evidentiary hearing to say he's not guilty in a way that doesn't open it up for the prosecution to use on cross-examination in what becomes a trial without a trial when we're not prepared for it?
Right.
So I thought of a very simple formula, and it worked. What did you discuss with your previous counsel about this? And that limited to what he discussed with his previous counsel.
Right, I see.
And I denied it. I told them I didn't kill King. They couldn't go any farther than the context of what he told
right.
his previous counsel. Huey was breathing hard
to get a confession.
To get an account from Ray. Of course, a confession.
Right.
But beginning with an account. And Ray is desperate, trying to avoid it. And Haynes is putting all the pressure on to get Ray to do it. And this gives you an idea of this wonderful dry sense of humor Ray has.
Mm-hmm.
So he finally writes out the most outlandish account he can think of.
Mm-hmm.
That he was sitting downstairs in the car. Raoul fires the shot out of the bathroom, comes running down, and puts a white sheet over himself.
I know, to be inconspicuous. That sort of looked like, to me, like that would be the craziest scene.
Obviously. Well,
yeah.
Huey went crazy over it.
Mm-hmm.
But people are trying to make one that's for real. But Huey understood it.
Okay.
That was the whole source of that. It was just to get Huey off of his back.
Okay. Back on that grand jury, when did Huey talk before a grand... When did he appear?
I think it was February 7th. You can see the transcript, and you know damn well this wasn't taken by any court reporter.
So in other words, Huey had it done and took it out, and that's against every possible grand jury, kind of.
As a precaution, Percy Foreman took possession of everything Huey got from Ray to protect Foreman. Huey didn't have it. It was in Foreman's safe in the Peabody Hotel. But Huey didn't have to appear there. He wanted to. You understand that this appearance before the grand jury was sandwiched by two payments to Foreman by Huey. Jim can give you the story better.
Okay.
That reminds me of another interesting thing. On these strange people, the Rays, all of whom are supposed to be criminals, and how every word has stacked up. The funniest part of this whole thing is John Ray's account of what happened when Stanton told Foreman, hey, Renfro Hayes is about to levy on... Huey had no first-person knowledge.
I see, because at this point, Huey is ostensibly identified with the defense.
Right.
And he goes to the grand jury. Okay.
Right, and all he does is... And he has no first-person knowledge. Mm-hmm. He just delivers long lectures and diatribes about how Ray has to be guilty. Now, this, I think, is in evidence. And if it is, of course, you can have it. Mm-hmm. Nothing could be more improper. How many reporters are going to jail over just this? It's the same Huey, you understand, who wouldn't appear to be questioned in the evidentiary hearings.
Right.
And flew farther.
I know.
To Nashville.
Then he went on a tour to Israel and a few other things.
Yeah.
And you didn't participate in the deposition of him basically because you...
I don't know why, but I think it was because it was expected that the deposition had no standing.
I see.
And the judge held that that wasn't true. I was in court when the judge held that that wasn't true.
Mm-hmm.
Huey did more than that. The tape of the first Channel 13 show in New York wasn't good. He went back to New York and retaped it.
Mm-hmm.
Poor old mother.
Were there two of them? There were two Huey tapes, right?
There were two Huey tapes, only one used. The first one wasn't of good quality. So
oh, but
there's
only,
over.
It was only one parter. The one
only
the
one show.
Part, yeah.
They have yet to air me.
Uh-huh. Well, you haven't had the data that. That one is one I want to check back on because someone mentioned it to me. I've got a Huey / Foreman fan at CBS because he keeps on alluding to these things. You know, he's a friend of both of theirs. So I said, sure, I'll look at it.
I think we have a transcription of an audio tape of that show.
Oh, that would be...
Ask Jim about that.
Okay.
I had a friend of mine tape it as it was aired. Frankly, I think Ray has a lot of issues against that station. And I warned the station in advance that there was no chance of Huey not doing it.
Mm-hmm. Why don't I turn it off for a second? I have a couple of notes that I made.
There's only one thing that makes sense
mm-hmm.
of that camera buying. And it's two parts. It is being in a position to steady King's movements. So that he can be killed, and dependent on Ray, because the same photographic equipment was readily available in Birmingham. Ordinarily, be available in any store. Kodak stuff's not that scarce.
Mm-hmm.
But Ray never got the right stuff, and he finally told me that he offered Raul the camera, and Raul said he didn't want it. I think he said that was in Mexico. The wrong camera. And he never did get the refund that was doing.
Yeah. Just chasing him around. Now we know where to find it, send the money back. Okay, so that. But he never took pictures, never did anything. He just.
Pardon me?
He never took pictures or
not
anything.
Not with the movie. Mm-mm. No. He returned the camera.
Okay. So that is nothing.
But the interesting thing about that is, to me, is still the way I used it in frame up.
Mm-hmm.
He knew in advance when he would be where. Somebody was moving around like pieces on a chessboard.
Okay.
But he was dependent on them, you see. He was trying to get false papers to get out of the country.
Right.
And the oddest part of all is if he had waited one day, he wouldn't have even had escaped from Missouri. The case was reversed.
Really?
Yeah. Less than 24 hours. Jim may remember the exact time. The case on which he was there serving 15 years was actually reversed.
I never saw that anywhere.
What
an irony, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, his conviction?
Yeah.
What was he doing? What kind of did he
Some kind of a petty crime. Robbing a chain store or
right,
something.
And then they put him in as a perpetual kind of offender.
Yeah.
And,
okay. Yeah, they gave him 15 years for it. Or he had 15
years.
So
you talk about someone who just made a couple of wrong moves by, in terms of timing.
Well, you remember I told you about Jerry and chewing gum.
Right.
I've never found a single really violent thing this man did in his life.
Mm-hmm.
He apparently was a little bit severe, but not serious, according to somebody's account, with a cab driver in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
But that apparently is the most violent thing he's ever done in his life.
Mm-hmm.
I've never even heard him curse. He's had some pretty strong provocation, too.
Yeah, I believe that. What about that, I saw his name in the Rolling Stone article. That guy who's an old Memphis Press Cemetery reporter who's now an investigator who's been fooling around.
Some investigator. He quotes Jim and me without even interviewing either one of us.
Yes, I would have guessed he would have talked to you by reading it. He hadn't spoken to him.
He didn't. They picked that up from a frame-up. Then some woman on the staff called me up to check the quotes. He never spoke to either one of us.
Mm-hmm.
Taken from our work, of course.
Except how would he have, I mean, it looked to me, didn't he say, Jim said that something's full of shit?
Yeah. Oh, that was when he called him up to check it.
Oh, okay. Fine. He was going to check, I think he was checking out the Livingstone theory or something, which sounds similar to the
But what I am saying is that the other quotes attributed to Jim and me do not come from interviews with us.
I see. Okay.
I never even heard of this guy before. I never had any conversation with him.
Uh-huh.
My first knowledge was when this woman on the staff of Rolling Stone called me up to confirm the quotes.
Okay, now these quotes are, I'm not talking about the author now, I'm talking about the other reporter. What is his name, Chazer or something like that?
Isn't it Mick something, McAllen or something? I've forgotten, I saw the story.
I don't think so. No, but there seems to be a guy who used to work for the Press Cemetery, who's now working with him. Doing private
Oh, you're talking about Wayne Chastain.
Chastain, that's the guy. Yeah, that's what
he's
I'm talking
He's a
about.
Nice guy, but he's lost in all of it.
Is he lost in all of it?
He's the guy that got fired.
Oh, okay.
He's the guy whose brains I was picking until 2, 3 o'clock in the morning.
Right, and that's the one who now is an inventor. He's a freelancer, as we call it.
He's a lawyer.
Uh-huh, I didn't know that.
Hale even tried to keep him from getting to his own swearing-in ceremonies by keeping him under subpoena.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And in order to hide it, he issued a personal check that I saw when he brought it and showed it to me. He was worried about what to do for his witness fee.
Yeah. Let's go back a little bit to Livingston and Atlanta and Chastain. Okay, they're the ones who are talking about who, in fact, you know, solving the crime rather than acquitting, right? Have you looked at this stuff, or you just...
I don't know about the Atlanta stuff except what's appeared in the paper. I have my suspicions about it. I know the Cliff story. Jim was confronted with this the night before. Jim Lesar.
Okay, fine.
The night before he's to depose Foreman.
Mm-hmm.
Just imagine a legal situation in which the senior counsel aren't prepared to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob starts talking to Bud about it in indirections, trying to keep it from Jim. And finally they decide that it's necessary not to interfere with Jim, sort of what the Bob's doing. And Jim called me right away from Houston. The whole thing, on the face of it, doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, if there was a conspiracy, it becomes a federal crime under the civil rights law.
Mm-hmm.
And the state can't give immunity on that.
Uh-huh.
So on that simple basis alone, the whole thing lacks credibility. And the rest of the story also lacks credibility. There's no part of it that makes sense. What it is, I don't know. But for real, it can't be.
Okay.
Now, apparently this guy, Cliff, is a criminal. I understand from Bobby's in jail now.
Mm-hmm.
And the odd thing is that he was from Windsor, Ontario, and the first thing Henry Hale did after the evidentiary hearing was to go to Windsor, Ontario. And he sends me a provocative little personal postcard from Windsor, Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he could have been there for other purposes, one of which is that Penn Jones made a speech there at the time. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it was at a time when he should have been pretty busy
mm-hmm.
in preparing his written closing arguments.
Yeah. What about the Byron Watson story?
I don't believe it. It may be true in and of itself, but I know of no basis for connecting it with the actual King assassination.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that this is what they palmed off on the evening.
Yeah, that just sounds to me like it's all the same story.
Yeah.
Now, is that the same story that Livingston is on?
No. No, that's a different story. The Cliff story is a different story.
Okay, I don't know the Livingston story. I just
well, that's of a guy named Cliff, mm-hmm. who was the intermediary, supposedly, for the guys who really did the killing. And they're made
because... Oh,
that's
the guy who goes with the pen name and the... Okay, you just found his real name and the stone piece. He was mentioned as... We have Jack Robinson or something. I mean,
oh, no, that's Chastain. No,
well, I'm confused.
The Livingston story, and Bud was in on this. They had a meeting up at Detroit or whatever. Is that a guy named Cliff approached Livingston.
Mm-hmm.
Livingston thought he was going to be killed. And he represented the men who did the crime, and for immunity, they would testify, and they would also name the people who paid them. Their motive was that they only got part of their pay, and they wanted to get vengeance. And I think it was $250,000 job. And they even had in mind a wealthy black as one of the number of men who put up the money.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Chastain story, he's really talking about a real person. He calls him Jack Armstrong,
right.
Or Jack Youngblood, about whom Robin Moore wrote the book Devil to Pay. It's a romanticized version.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack Youngblood was in Memphis at about that time. My source is a lawyer friend of him, of his, who saw him there.
Mm-hmm.
The old friends, they used to run around together.
Mm-hmm.
But there's certain things about Wayne's story that give me trouble, and I've explained them to Wayne. One thing you wouldn't expect, okay, is that a man would make himself so conspicuous for no apparent purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he's going and getting sausages and eggs at the scene of the crime. And making himself conspicuous. What purpose did he serve in all this?
Yeah.
You know, things don't work that way, Esther.
Yeah,
he asked me about the New Rebel Motel, and we talked about it earlier.
Yeah, I was just wondering, did
he have where Ray delivered the rifle to Raoul. It and a number of other places, in my opinion, have importances that nobody has seen. You just can't walk around wearing gloves all the time, and you can't wipe everything clean of fingerprints.
Mm-hmm.
But there's nothing in the world to keep the FBI from going in and dusting everything for fingerprints. They got plenty of manpower. So this is one of the places where I'm sure the FBI had a good chance of picking up the trace of those people with whom Ray was associated. However, I think that too little understood is the part that everybody missed and the FBI knew about and suppressed. And that is the fact that the night before Ray was at the New Rebel Motel, mm-hmm. he was at the DeSoto Motel, this hot street joint I told you about. And the interesting thing about the DeSoto Motel, besides from its less than unique quality, is the fact that it is on the road from New Orleans and is the first motel of that sort in Mississippi when you cross the Tennessee state line. And I don't think that Ray blundered into the place as unique as that,
mm-hmm.
coming from Alabama or Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a blunder, but I didn't go into that with him because it's the kind of area in which he gets uneasy, and I don't want him to feel that my primary interest is in solving the crime. He did tell me that he shifted rooms there. Interestingly enough, only every other room is a room. The other one is only a garage. After a half hour, somebody knocks at the door in the garage and says, your time is up.
Okay, because in the book you made quite a point about they never said the auto registration, it was never signed. The
hotel registration.
Yeah.
Yeah. What probably happened is that the things he didn't do, people at the motel did.
Okay.
But that's not evidence against him. They have to put them on to testify.
Right, okay. But now, I mean, I couldn't tell at that point from reading that book whether maybe he wasn't there or not, but now you say he wasn't.
No, I didn't know it then.
Right, okay.
I left it deliberately elliptical because I didn't know.
Right, okay. But he was there and that's not
But he tells me he was there and they met with Raoul there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when he turned over the rifle to Raoul. Mm-hmm. I believe it.
Okay.
You know, even in a flop house like that, anybody walking in with a rifle would be pretty conspicuous.
Yeah.
So, the package was brought in. It was wrapped and disguised. And the last place in the world anybody would have shot King in that area was in the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
Don't let me forget to show you these pictures that I took.
Right, okay, I do want to see them. Stein.
I don't really know the story about Stein, except that he's a shifty character. As I remembered, 6 arrests with no convictions, including drugs. Jimmy wondered if he was on pills or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't really go farther than that. The Raoul Escobar story, I arranged with a lawyer Bud and I both know in New Orleans, who was Navy intelligence and well connected in criminal law, to bring us together with Raoul Escobar,
mm-hmm.
Who is a state trooper. And it was for the This guy invited us to go to a Sugar Bowl meeting. It was one of 2 invitations I had for the Sugar Bowl meeting that year. The other was from the woman who was in charge of the women's end of being hostess. I drank one afternoon with her, a friend of mine on the John Kennedy assassination, a
mm-hmm.
Public relations man in New Orleans. And the last minute he gave me some lead. We had a little time. In the Royal Orleans drinking before he was doing federal court. And he gave me some leads that I went to the courthouse and made handwritten notes on as fast as I could because I was about to catch a plane.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what's happening. And I turned them over to Bud and Jim. But Bud decided against accepting his invitation for that New Year's. And as I remember, it was 1971.
Mm-hmm.
I think we should have done it.
Okay. I would almost go along with your. I gather from Jim and from you that you don't think it's either your responsibility or even a realm of possibility to solve the crime. I mean, that's not what a private citizen should be doing.
That hasn't been our focus. I think it is within the realm of possibility. But I don't think we can do it with Ray's help. For 2 reasons. First, I think he'll be unwilling. And second, and this has 2 parts, one is how much does he know that can be helpful to the sin? And after all of these experiences, where will knowledge begin and confabulation end?
Right.
But I don't think the crime is insoluble. I think the FBI has all the leads it needs.
Mm-hmm.
But if they're going to depend on somebody like Ray to bear witness, they're going to be lost. Going to have to do some old-fashioned, solid, hard police work.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's impossible.
Mm-hmm.
My belief is that they don't want to.
Yeah. You like it just the way it is.
If they have to, then they may be forced into something else. But they feel they're better off the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
They're spending a lot of time.
Yeah.
No, it's just that Jim and I have never tried to solve the crime.
finish with the non-verbal. I'll just go through this again. Turn that off for a second, soon.
The cigarette butts, Ray doesn't smoke. They were in the ashtray. One of the things that surprised Henry Hale when we were exercising discovery in Bubba Blackwell's office.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very unusual situation. They had all these boxes.
Mm-hmm.
They wheel them in one after another. You can't do anything. They seal them up just the way they were. And I wanted to see these cigarette butts because they were switched from the Atlanta office to the New Orleans office.
Mm-hmm.
And Henry was wondering about my interest in it. And I said, I can tell you what kind they are. He said, what kind are they? And I said, Viceroy. And his eyes opened up, and he didn't carry it any further.
Mm-hmm.
And they are Viceroy. But there's not one that shows the Viceroy label. I don't think this got into a hearing, so this may be under a protective order, too.
Mm-hmm.
But Ray doesn't smoke.
Right.
So obviously, the FBI had leads from the cigarette butts, from the clothing that couldn't have been raised, from the fingerprints that were not raised. We're not talking about bishops, we're talking about criminals.
Yeah.
You remember I was talking
about... So that would have been in the car from before...
Oh, not from before Ray had it.
No, I'm saying from before Ray took off from Memphis.
Correct.
When he and Raoul were still piling around together.
That's right. He was
driving Raoul's car he's driving around in Raoul's car and has the tire fixed. And he ends up with Raoul's car with somebody's cigarette butts and somebody's clothes and not his own.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they got plenty of leads. But that still doesn't let them prove who pulled the trigger.
Right.
And that would take a lot of work. They're not willing to do it. Now, they may be doing a lot of this without us knowing about it. But I have no way of knowing. Now, there are other things involved in this.
Mm-hmm.
Did Jim tell you about some people I turned on a TV show I did?
Yep.
Well, we'll let that wait for another time.
Okay.
You come back again, I'll play you a tape of William Knight.
Okay.
But there was advanced knowledge that King was going to be killed. I'm not talking now.
You're not talking
about what is in frame-up. And you believe me, I left several cases out of frame-up because I didn't want the people to be killed.
Yeah.
I didn't begin to use all those tapes.
Mm-hmm.
Only one I used was Kyle's.
Okay, and the Byron Watson case is not what you're talking about in terms of Vance
Miller.
What? Byron Watson.
No. I had nothing to do with that. I have some knowledge of it.
Yeah.
And there's a certain amount of it that seems credible, but I don't believe it fits.
Okay. What am I leaving out? I mean, can you think of major omissions that I've made? I am now getting...
You know what I'd suggest on this, Esther?
Yeah.
Why don't we... Let me go and get these affidavits executed, and while we're doing that, we're driving... We drive about 15 minutes.
Okay, so
you'll be able to make notes of these things.
Okay. I want to see your pictures, too.